The Gita speaks of God's own example. And Sri Aurobindo at several places in Essays on the Gita speaks about it, emphasizes upon it, because in the course of spiritual evolution of man, there are two possible routes that he takes. One is the way of the scripture. He reads all that needs to be done, the path and the way, and tries to follow by using his own will. The other is simply he reads the stories of God, what he did, how he was, how he moved among men, how he related with humanity, and something in his heart is inspired by that touch, and he follows in the footsteps of God. These have been two basic approaches. The first is contained, for instance, in the Vedas, the Upanishads, the Gita, and the second approach is typified in the Bhagavat. We read about God and we try to follow to the best or worst of our possibilities and abilities in his steps. So when Sri Aurobindo is introducing us Savitri, he is introducing to us Savitri the avatar, who she is, how does God become human, what he does, what he feels, what is his state of consciousness, what is his inner attitude when he becomes human. And it sounds so simple to us that God becomes human. Oh, it's so easy. God can do anything, so he can become human. He can become anything. But if we just reflect for a while that God becoming human means that infinite vastness becoming small, very small, very, very small. Because though we all have very good and very high opinion about ourselves, because in the present course of evolution we stand at the peak of evolved beings on earth, yet when we compare the distance between man and God, it's something stupendous. So for God to become human is truly the greatest of sacrifices. And yet he does it, he puts on the mortal cloak so that we can move in his steps. Otherwise his footsteps are beyond, none of us can follow it. The Ishupanishad speaks about it as he who is swifter than the gods. Sri Aurobindo speaks about it in The Mother when he says that to follow her steps is impossible even for the swiftest minds and the freest intelligence. And yet she becomes like us, one of us, speaks the language which we would understand, deals with us as a human being would deal. And that is an example which is easier and comes closer to her heart. So who is this human mother? When we read about her, who is this divine mother who has become human? It really inspires us to follow those steps, to be at least a little portion, a little part, something of that. That is indeed the transformation Sri Aurobindo speaks about. Mortal nature putting on the nature of the divine. It is not that transformed beings will be here to do all kinds of miracles and impress everyone with their erudition and powerful knowledge of the scriptures. That's not what is transformation. Transformation is to become the divine man. Right now we are the animal man. So 90% of our nature is governed by the animal consciousness. And little bit, sometimes, some sparks of humanity come out of us. But to transmute man the animal into man divine, that is the transformation, the change of nature. And what is that nature? We find in Savitri. What is that nature that she brings into the human consciousness. We read a little bit yesterday on page 8. This is the day when Savitri has woken up to the fact of her husband's death. She had already known it, and she doesn't speak about it to anyone. So Shubindo says, somewhere in the middle, in its grim rendezvous with death and fear, no cry broke from her lips, no call for aid. How very different from the way we react to a little scratch. Not only cry breaks from our lips, very soon the whole colony, first the house, then the colony, then our little world knows that we had a scratch. And if people don't visit us, we feel, oh, he claimed to be my friend. He has not come. Does he not know that I have this fracture? And here is she, facing the grim. She has an appointment written in a diary, appointment with death. And this has been written 1 year back. And yet, in its grim rendezvous with death and fear, no cry broke from her lips, no call for aid. Much later, Sri Aurobindo will tell us that even to her in-laws, she does not tell them that this is the fate that your son is going to meet, lest their hearts be troubled by the grief to come. She faces it all alone. She told the secret of her woe to none. Calm was her face, and courage kept her mute. Two kinds of courage man knows. One which is not courage but rashness, typified in the story of Ramayana, Ravana. He keeps boasting and is rushing at every step. The other kind of courage which keeps us mute, silent, strong, the power of immobility. We find in the very first canto, it ends with that. Immobile in herself, she gathered force. Courage kept her mute. Yet only her outward self suffered and strove. Even her humanity was half divine. What kind of consciousness she wants to bring into us? Her spirit opened to the spirit in all. It's not through mental association and vital socialization. Sri Aurobindo says the secret of unity lies in a spiritual opening, a spiritual oneness to the spirit in all beings. And therefore she could read the hidden messages of the flowers. Even when she would go and pluck a vegetable, they would communicate with her. When trees were being axed, a tree goes and reports to her at night, "Mother, they are planning to cut me down. What should I do?" And she calls next day and asks, "Are you planning to cut the tree? Don't cut it. How did you know, Mother?" And that place happened to be the center of Auroville. That's where the tree stands. So, see how non-ritualistic she is. No, no, it has to be the center. Doesn't matter. The tree has to be cut. She says, "No, the tree came and complained to me. Don't cut the tree. Move it a little more off center. My temple can be a little away from the center. I'm everywhere. It doesn't matter. But the tree is there. Let it remain there." This is the kind of consciousness she brings into earth. Even to a lizard, beast. So many stories are there. The story of the donkey who stood by when she was giving her balcony darshan, and she reports, bring that near because he is very receptive. At one point when Sri Aurobindo saw the bullock cart man hitting the bullocks, he was summoned and he was told, the bullocks are more receptive than you are. Indeed, they were more receptive. They were more receptive to the mother's grace, to the mother's force than human beings. And this way she was opening to everything around, holding all creatures in her arms. Her nature felt all nature as its own, a part living within all lives she bore. Aloof, she carried in herself the world. Her dread was one with the great cosmic dread. Her strength was founded on the cosmic mights. The universal mother's love was hers. This is the kind of love she brings to this earth. For a long time, of course, we just visited mother's room, and we know there is a place called the mother's room. For a long time, she did not have a room to herself. The mother didn't have a separate room. And when people would come and want to meet her in private, there was a fridge kept that room down below where she was giving interview, where she would rest while work is going on in the same room. But there is no separate room. And she would have to open the door of the fridge to allow for privacy. This is the way of the divine. And the first thing we want when we want to take to spiritual life is, let me build a house, let me have a place to myself, let me have all the luxuries and riches. Then I will think of the divine. Once I am well settled. And we are so well settled that even to move an inch appears like unsettling. And the divine comes, he remains ever unsettled. Look at Sri Aurobindo, look at the mother, how they remain unsettled in a way all their life. All the time. And then it's because Dhyoman Bhai saw that one day she wanted to take some rest and she didn't have a place to herself. So he asked mother, mother, I think we should build a room for you. And she says, no, I don't, we cannot afford it now. This is the kind of consciousness, this is the kind of love she brings on earth. We read a similar description later on. This is on page 362. Aware of the universal self in all. Page 362. Aware of the universal self in all, she turned to living hearts and human forms. Her soul's reflections, complements, counterparts. Each one of us is nothing from that great sense of the great I, nothing else but a portion of ourselves. That is how the divine sees everything. Everything is a portion and part and parcel of itself. But we have this divided consciousness by which we see everything as other than myself. In one of his poems, Sri Aurobindo brings this out so forcefully, the one self, all are deceived, do what the one power dictates. He ends by saying, my rival's downfall is my own disgrace. I look at my enemy and see Krishna's face. This was a fact of his experience. And this is how she looked at the whole universe, not like our divided and dividing consciousness. Her soul's reflections, complements, counterparts, the close undying portions of her being, the close outlying portions of her being, divided from her by walls of body and mind, yet to her spirit bound by ties divine. Overcoming invisible hedge and mass defense, and the loneliness that separates soul from soul, she wished to make all one immense embrace, that she might house in it all living things, raised into a splendid point of seeing light, out of division's dense inconscient cleft, and make them one with God and world and her. This is the kind of world she wants to create. This is the new creation she wants to bring. A new creation where we open to the sense of the universal divine in all beings, in each creature, not just human beings. Because constantly when we think of all beings, we think of humanity. But the spirit of oneness in which everything dwells, and that oneness she wants to bring into us. But what is our response? Only a few responded to her call. Still fewer felt the screen divinity. The divine screens himself, takes great care to hide himself. So unlike us. We have a little experience and we blabber out and talk about it even 10 years later or 20 years later. I had this experience that time. And here is the divine screening himself even from those whom he loves. Because if he came just as he is, who could come near her? Who could dare to come close to her? We would all be reduced to ashes. Someone asked Mother, Mother, why did you come like us? She says, My child, if I came in my full glory and resplendent form, would you be able to bear it? This is a beautiful story of a little girl in her teens who stood in the queue, and she was constantly feeling, she's divine, they say, why don't I see? And suddenly, in a moment of apocalypse, something was revealed to her. A vision, wonderful, so strong and powerful that she fainted at once. Mother asked her to stay in that state, not to be disturbed. After about half an hour, she was picked up. She came back to her normal awareness. And precisely because she hides herself, we wonder, is she really divine? Because we have an idea of divine. Divine should always have at least more than two arms, at least four arms. We don't know of two-armed divines. But all avatars come with two arms, 2 feet, 2 eyes. Only when they are disembodied beings in some other heaven, they have four arms. Mother says in one of her small notes, reflections, that if I came with 1,000 arms, then you would think I am divine, because I have become like you. Same is true of Sri Aurobindo. He is reported to have remarked, Nalanda writes in his reminiscences, that they came with him and they would go and play football and go around, and youngsters. So he writes so beautifully that we were all having fun the way, you know, people that age. And Sri Aurobindo would not say anything. He would, you know, we would go tell him certain things, have our own life. Then one day he is reported to have said, almost under his breath, when will you become conscious of your aim? I have come so close to you. I have made myself so very small. I can't make myself more small. When will you make the effort to rise a little higher? Just a little higher, so that I can catch your hand. And that's the reason why in Shobindo's writings, we have these writings very interestingly, most of his writings, except letters and yoga, which are very direct. There is a purpose why Shobindo has made them seemingly so difficult. He didn't want to make it difficult, of course, not with a view. But they are high truths brought down to the level of the higher mind, and he has placed them there. Now, this is the mind which is closest to us. Come, strive at least, stretch out our necks. We don't want that. This is very difficult. Can you give us a simpler version? Of course, letters on yoga are simple and direct. But the beauty is that when we try to read them, we actually, it uplifts us. Many people say that they sleep when they read Sri Aurobindo. It's an excellent sign. It's precisely because our normal mind, our ordinary mind, when it tries to stretch itself out, makes that little extra effort to reach out, it falls into a state of trance. It sleeps. And it's so much better to sleep reading one sentence of Sri Aurobindo than to remain awake whole day and think about ourselves. It's so much better to sleep reading just one sentence of him. So he comes so close to us. And of course, mother, knowing our difficulty, says, okay, I'll come down still further. Steps, 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 many steps she creates between one level and another. And yet, still fewer felt this green divinity and strove to mate its godhead with their own. Approaching with some kinship to her heights, uplifted towards luminous secrecies, or conscious of some splendor hidden above, they leaped to find her in a moment's flash, glimpsing a light in a celestial vast, but could not keep the vision and the power, and fell back to life's dull, ordinary routine. In a moment's flash, it's revealed that we are face to face with her whom we seek deep hid within. As we find Yama tells Nachiketa, this is Aditi seated in the center of your heart. This is that thou seekest. And in a moment, the veil is rent and we are face to face with the world mother. But then, after a while, doubt, depression, discouragement, skepticism, life's dull, ordinary routine surrounds us again. Mother would tell us, hold back to that moment. Hold back to the memory of that moment. That will pull you out. We have beautiful, and she is not saying something which she has not gone through. In life we face many times what, you know, we are called as, we people call as rejection. And there's so much made out of the psychology of rejection. Modern psychology deals a lot about rejection. Rejection from parent, rejection from people, rejection from those whom we love. But what is the greatest rejection that one can ever face? Rejection from the divine. Of course, divine doesn't reject anyone. Sri Aurobindo would tell us, even her rejections are not rejections, but postponement. It is a preparation. Yet there can be a sense of rejection. Has the divine abandoned me? Has he left me? Does he really care for me? Does he bother for me? Look at these nice people. They have a flat to stay in Pondicherry. Why can't I have? I am so far away. many times we can face this kind of feelings, and mother has gone through this too. When mother leaves after coming here in 1914, she had to leave because of the outbreak of the war. And there are all kinds of things written everywhere why she had to leave, because she is divine and Shobindu is divine. Both were conscious of their divinity and their mission together, and why the mother had to leave. Now there are all kinds of explanations, philosophical, intellectual, people have written. In my own limited way, my understanding is very simple, that she knew that she has to experience everything so that she can actually show the path to the human consciousness. And the extreme that one can ever face in life is to get a so-called rejection slip from the divine. When she moves away from Pondicherry after coming here, the mother says, "I was waiting. If only once he could say, just stay on, I would have stayed." Look at the surrender, look at the intensity of aspiration. If once he could say, just stay on, I would have stayed. But she moves on and moves from one side, from the deep security of one in whom she has found the builder of the worlds. She moves away from one who was always there in her dreams. It was like a dream realized. One whom she had already formed a permanent relationship and called him as Krishna. One to whom she had given everything of her. And yet she has to move away from him. What it would have caused, what kind of pain and suffering, we cannot imagine. And she is moving towards which place from that security and that love and that Ananda? She is moving into a world torn apart by the First World War. She is moving into all the horror and the pain. She would live for a while, life in the trenches, look at men carrying dead bodies, and she would write, "When they were carrying these bodies in the war, I saw in these young men something very noble, something very beautifully human. These men were not doing yoga. They were not sitting in an ashram. They were stretcher bearers of the dead and the wounded." And she would write, "I saw in their eyes a glint of divinity, and they were so receptive that a little divine touch and they would respond." She had to go through all that experience, which was a veritable hell. In fact, she did something which, from an occult standpoint, which should never be done. She left her psychic being here and went with her outer consciousness into the world, exposing herself to all the dangers and difficulties. She fell so critically ill that she almost died. So all this she faces, and what she writes at that point of time, it is documented in one of her prayers. These are the two prayers written just after her leaving Pondicherry. She left on 22nd February 1915, just after, a day after her birthday. And what she must have gone through. And the first entry after that period is March 3rd, 1915. It is on board the ship. Now, we all know her entry when she saw Sri Aurobindo and she writes something. And now this is the entry when she is on board the ship. First entry after she departs. Volume 1, Prayers and Meditations. And these are two prayers. I'll read in parts, 291 and 292 pages. Solitude, a harsh, intense solitude, and always this strong impression of having been flung headlong into a hell of darkness. Never at any moment of my life, in any circumstances, have I felt myself living in surroundings so entirely opposite to all that I am conscious of as true, so contrary to all that is the essence of my life. We complain of our circumstances. Mother, you ask us to do this, do that. We don't even have time to sit for meditation. Everybody around me is so full of bitterness. She would tell us something about that also. But first she says, I am plunged into circumstances which are just the very opposite of all that I am, all that is true in my essence. So she has to experience it. That's why she could tell us and give us the assurance, even if you are in the thick of darkness, hold on to faith. Sometimes when the impression and the contrast grow very intense, I cannot prevent my total submission from taking on a hue of melancholy. Divine lamenting? Did not Sati question Rama's lament? How can he be lamenting when he is divine? Divine knows our deepest thoughts, our closely guarded secrets, what we go through in life. And that's why the avatar brings hope. If he just came and did some miracles and went away, never experienced all that human beings experience, then how could he tell us? That's the difference when we follow a God and we follow the divine, become human. Gods don't know what human beings go through. They give us boons and they take away as soon. That's why they say gods give boons like that, and when they are angry, they just don't care, break into pieces. What does it matter? Matter is for them a playfield. But she identifies with the deepest and the darkest thoughts that human beings can go through. We hear about Buddha going through a phase of doubt. Am I really on the way? Is there something to be found? Is there a way? 6 years I have given myself to tapasya. Still I don't find the way. And the Divine Mother comes in the form of a little girl and tells him the way. We hear the story of Christ. He doubts. You have sent me with this mission? And why have you put me in the hands of these? Is this what I have come here for? We hear the story of Guru Nanak when he's put inside the jail and slashed with the Mughals, the invaders. They slash him with whips and he questions, you are there? Where are you? The same thing we see in the story of Meera. They go through these and much more. The avatar goes through 10 times more than what any human consciousness can experience. So she says, I cannot prevent my total submission from taking on a hue of melancholy, and the calm and mute converse with the master within is transformed for a moment into an invocation that almost supplicates, O Lord, what have I done that thou hast thrown me thus into the somber night? What have I done that this night engulfs me? She says, for a moment this comes to me. But she knows this is not the way. So she immediately says, but immediately the aspiration rises still more ardent. What does this aspiration say? Spare this being all weakness. Suffer it to be the docile and clear-eyed instrument of thy work, whatever that work may be. That is the path she has come to show us. If the night is too profound, then we must aspire even more intensely. And that's why she could tell us with utmost truth of conviction, born out of experience, that hold on, at the end of the darkest tunnel, there is light. And the next page, again we read, Thou dost plunge me, O Lord, into the thickest darkness. Actually, we can't even imagine or fathom. She was moving with someone who, for all outer purposes, is one whom worldly point of view will say her closest, and yet from him she would receive enough suffering, and she is moving away from that in whom she has found the supreme. She is moving from a world of bliss to a world of utter chaos and darkness. And with all that happening inside and in her external being, she would not tell us all that. That's the beauty of it. She just, this is entry in her diary, Thou dost plunge me, O Lord, into the thickest darkness. This means, if this happens to us, we would think this means Thou hast abandoned me and all my experiences were rubbish. But she writes, this means that Thou hast established Thy light so firmly in me that Thou knowest it will stand this perilous ordeal. So whenever we meet with a great difficulty, Mother would tell us in one of her writings later on, whenever you meet with a difficulty in life, you must say to yourself, the Divine has taught me to be worthy of it. This was born of a real experience. She never gave philosophy. That's the beauty of Mother's writings. Nothing is philosophy. Everything is so real, and so concrete and so practical. This means that Thou hast established Thy light so firmly in me that Thou knowest it will stand this perilous ordeal. Otherwise, wouldst Thou have chosen me for the descent into the vortex of this hell as Thy torch-bearer? Where should the torch-bearer go? Not towards the light. The light needs him not. He would go towards the night. I made an assignation with the night. In the abyss was fixed our rendezvous, carrying in my breast God's deathless light. I came her dark and dangerous heart to woe. And in Savitri he would tell us, he who would save the race must share its pain. How shall he otherwise know what it means to be human? Wouldst Thou have judged my heart strong enough not to fail? My hand firm enough not to tremble? But even there, look at these subtle distinctions he makes. When she lets off these feelings, one could feel very egoistic about oneself. Oh, I am so strong. That's why the Divine has plunged me into darkness, and we can almost fall in love with the darkness. But she brings that psychic touch into it. It's not the voice of the ego saying, Thou hast cast me into the infernal hell because I am strong and mighty. That's not what she's saying. So she immediately brings that psychic touch, and yet my individual being knows how weak and powerless it is when Thou dost not manifest Thy presence. It is more denuded than most people who do not know or care for Thee. Without Thee I am helpless. I know nothing. I can do nothing. I am nothing. This is how she would write in one of her diary entries. The strength is because of thee. The hope is because of thee. In thee alone lies its strength and ability. If thou art pleased to make use of it, nothing will be too difficult to accomplish, no task too vast and complex. But if thou shouldst withdraw, just a poor child is left, capable only of nestling in thy arms and sleeping there in this sweet, dreamless sleep where nothing else exists but thou. This is the golden path. She shows us a path which sometimes moves through darkness, through battle, through struggle, through combat and strife, and yet to hold on to that faith, to that love that comes from the psychic presence. So beautifully Sri Aurobindo would tell us in The Divine Worker, I face earth's happenings with an equal soul. Thy unseen feet tread destiny's pathway in my front, life's whole tremendous theorem is thou complete. Failure is cradled on thy deathless arms. So what? If it appears as a failure, it is cradled on thy deathless arms. And what is victory? Victory is thy passage mirrored through fortune's glass. When you pass through, then no credit to myself. In this rude combat with the fate of man, thy smile within my heart makes all my strength. What is the source of strength? Sri Aurobindo says, it is because of the divine ananda within that I could bear and still would bear all that I have to go through. All the things that we threw on him and continue to throw on them, they bear it. Why? Because it's the divine ananda. What is the source of that strength in this rude combat with the fate of man? Thy smile within my heart makes all my strength. It labors ceaselessly at thy grandiose plan, indifferent to the time snake's crawling length. What is the sign of that touch? It is at once full of intense aspiration, but there is no impatience in it. Even if it takes 100 years, 1,000 years, 10,000 years, 1,000,000 years, this is to be done. For this alone is worth doing. This alone is worth being called a man, a human being, indifferent to the time snake's crawling length. And then he says, no power can slay my soul. It lives in thee. Thy presence is my immortality. This is the path that they come to show. This is the example that they show to us as the divine leaders of humanity. And we'll end with this passage from Savitri. Why Savitri has to face this pang? Oh, just 2 minutes. Yes, this is just one passage. Page 9, towards the end. With that, we'll just finish this book 1, canto 1, this part. All came back to her, earth and love and doom.